Hello. Good evening, everybody. Good evening in Israel. Good evening in the UK, in Europe. And what would we say in the US, Peter?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to our guests who joined us to hear about this special event. And very, very special and burning topic. So my name is Matan Rosenstrauch. I am an organizer for Meretz UK, and this is a joint event of Meretz UK and our American partner, Partners for Progressive Israel. So that's why we have many Brits and Americans joining us tonight. Maybe I can let Lawrence say a few words about Meretz UK before we introduce Peter. Lawrence?
Hi there.
Hello.
Can you hear me? Hi there.
Yes.
Hey, everyone. Hi. It's wonderful to be here. And thank you so much, Peter, before I go on, for agreeing to speak to us on this really important issue. We've got so many people from all over the world, from America, from the United Kingdom, also from Egypt. And incidentally, Peter's, one of his grandparents came from Egypt. So there's a connection there, from Benin, from Australia. It's tremendous to have you all here. About Meretz, Meretz UK is affiliated with Meretz in Israel, as is Partners for Progressive Israel, who are our co-hosts. I'd like to thank Ron Skolnick and Karen Shapiro and Dinesh as well, working on the technology. And lastly, thanks also to Hashemi Hatzayed Trust, who made this possible, and John Strawson. Suffice to say, Meretz is received the grand sum in Israel of 3 seats in the last election. But one issue that might appear would be the declining support of the left, but there was also potential, as they say in Chinese, a crisis is danger plus opportunity. So there's danger for all of us, I believe, as we'll hear in the evening, about the dangers of annexation, what it will mean both for Israelis and, of course, for Palestinians. But with that said, Meretz in the UK used to put on real live meetings. Of course, nobody does these days. So hence, this is our first and our joint webinar. And we basically define an area in which is support for Israel, support for peace, for social justice, economic justice, at a time when, as the title of Peter's talk suggests, democracy is somewhat in retreat, not only here, but indeed, arguably, even in America. We could segue to that issue, but that might come up later on. May I say just a few words about Peter, what I say, to save his modesty? Could I? Okay. Peter's really one of the leading thought leaders in America, certainly in the Jewish community. 10 years ago, almost to the day, he wrote quite a key article. It's about how there was a chasm opening up in the American Jewish community, if I'm characterizing it correctly, between the establishment on one hand and younger Jewish people on the other. And the issue of Israel was of great importance. At the time, 10 years ago, it seemed that many young Americans, many Jewish people generally, were drifting away from Israel, not feeling concerned about it. Now, I wonder, 10 years later, that was very prescient, it's true, and yet there's more engagement with Israel as well, in certain respects. So I think maybe that's enough for me for the moment. The format of the meeting would be, because we've got guests from so many places, even Benin and Egypt, as I said, Australia, South Africa, Britain, and largely America. So we'd really like to give you a chance to speak as well. But
maybe
all,
I can just add
some questions. Sure.
Just add something that's very important. How did we get to Peter? So Meretz is PPI is part of the Hatikva slate, which Peter is part of, along with many other progressive Jewish organizations in the United States. You had your elections, we haven't and might not have them here in the UK, but we also have a progressive slate here in the UK. So we are very proud to have you as an expert journalist, but also as a part of the Hatikva slate, Peter.
Yes, I was, it's an honor to be participating. I'm a great longtime admirer of Merit. And it was a real privilege to be part of the Hatikva slate. I'm not used to running for, any kind of elective office. It was a wonderful opportunity to be with people whose values I share. And one of the great joys for me about being engaged in this conversation is the way in which it's allowed me to get to know people from across the world who share a vision of a Jewish community that believes in democracy and human dignity. And I also just wanted to wish Lawrence, your director, happy birthday. I was told this is his birthday. Lawrence and I both share South African roots. So even though we don't know each other well, we share a bond that I was able to detect from the minute I heard his accent. So.
Thank you, Peter.
Mazel tov, Lawrence.
You're
only 35, right?
That's right. And I've been there for about 23 years. Yeah.
Okay, so just framing it, how it's going to be, we want to hear mostly from you, Peter, obviously, but we will leave a lot of time for Q&As. So if you have any question while Peter is speaking, simply write it in the chat, and in the Q&A part, we will just tell you to ask it. So we see each other, it's not a webinar, we are talking, we are meeting, the wonders of Zoom. And without further ado, so please do ask your questions, not statements, ask questions, please. And so we are here to speak about annexation, and it seems to be like something that was spoken about for years, but something that maybe for the Israeli right and Bibi Netanyahu, it wasn't worth doing. And the best for the Israeli right is to maintain the status quo of the occupation. So the first question that we must ask is, what happened? How did we get to this day, Peter?
So Benjamin Netanyahu has been prime minister since 2009. So I think the obvious question one has to ask is, if he was prime minister from 2009, why is this only emerging as a real possibility now? It's not that the Israeli government is particularly more right-wing in its composition than it was in previous iterations of the Netanyahu prime ministership. The Palestinians are, of course, are weak and divided, but they have been weak and divided, again, throughout his entire prime ministership. So I think the key variable that has shifted is the United States. That until 2016, you had the Obama administration creating a kind of guardrail around what the Netanyahu administration could do. And of course, with the support of Europe and other places in the world. And from early on, the Trump administration, despite its general incoherence about everything, I think has sent the general message that there are really no guardrails being imposed by the United States on Israeli behavior. And again, it's been a kind of, we saw that the United States was first willing to recognize Israeli control of East Jerusalem, recognizing the control of the Golan Heights, saying that settlement did not violate international law. Trump famously said, I don't have a position between one or two states. And I think all of this has given a kind of a green light. Now, there are still other limiting factors. There's the fear of what the Palestinians might do, whether there might be an uprising. There's the fear of what relationships might be like with Jordan and Egypt. There's European and international pressure. But given that, again, the Palestinians are weak, and that the Jordanians and Egyptians are also weak, and the general view from Arab governments has been a de-emphasis on the Palestinian question, I think that it would be right, make sense to assume that Netanyahu, who is generally stuck pretty close to his hawkish base in terms of the agenda that he's pursued, I think would take this opportunity to go forward with this.
Could I ask, this recently, there seems to have been, can you hear me? Oops, sorry.
Yeah. You are on mute, Lawrence.
Hi, can you hear me?
There we go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people say this is just a ploy, it's not really going to happen. I mean, there's even been talk from some settlers who, from their perspective, actually fear annexation because the other part of the deal is creation of a Palestinian state, which is a nightmare for some of them. Do you think this is just a tactical maneuver? Might it actually happen? Might coronavirus and various other crises in America intervene and throw it off rails?
Well, look, you could say that if your goal is to make Israeli control of the West Bank as permanent as possible without any repercussions, that annexation is counterproductive, right? Israel controls the West Bank already de facto. It's entrenching that control through settlement growth and the building of greater infrastructure. Why do you need to formalize it and then basically create some response by the Palestinians or the Arab world or the rest of the world that might cause you problems? Essentially, just continue to do what you're doing under the radar screen. If your goal is for Israel to control the West Bank, it's working, right? So I think that would be one perspective that people might have. It's also possible that people, as you alluded, Lawrence, there might be some in Netanyahu, around Netanyahu, who feel like, well, the quid pro quo for annexation would be that we have to implement certain parts of the Trump peace plan, and we don't want to do that because maybe that could impose some kind of limits on settlement growth. I would be very surprised, though, if the Trump administration uses annexation as a reason to stop the Netanyahu government from doing anything it wants. Frankly, I think if you look at this is the most important thing to understand about the Trump administration's engagement with Israel, is that it is overwhelmingly political. It is overwhelmingly focused on satisfying the interests of a segment of right-wing American Jewry and Christian evangelicals. I think Sheldon Adelson in particular plays an enormously important role. The kind of professional diplomats who might be concerned about America's international reputation, about destabilizing the Middle East, the process of foreign policy making has so fundamentally broken down inside the Trump administration that I don't think those people really have a view, nor does the Trump administration have the institutional capacity to drive forward a peace plan, which would require the kind of sustained diplomatic engagement that its band of kind of incompetent, corrupt buffoons didn't have, especially now that we're going into an election year. So these settlers may be concerned about what Trump might demand of them in response to annexation, but I would be surprised if he demands anything significant at all.
In the title of your talk, you do speak about Zionism and democracy in a post-two-state solution world. Maybe I'll go to the back of that and say post-two-state solution. Do you really believe that matters have got to such a pretty pass that a two-state solution, which is on the cards, what everybody is supposed to support, or when I say everybody, I mean major institutions and countries around the world, do you think that the time has passed and for us ever having a two-state solution? Do we have to think out of the box about something else?
Look, the challenge with the two-state solution is how could one ever conclusively say that it is either alive or dead, right? There's no objective metric by which one can assume that. I think the best one can say is that it has become harder to achieve, and there are other things that could happen that would signal that even more. If you think about what sustains the two-state solution, I think that there are several pillars. One is its status in international law. The fact that partition is the position of the United Nations and most countries around the world. So there's a kind of international legal position. The second is that it is the position that enjoys the most support in public opinion among both Israeli Jews and Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Now, it's been dropping in both populations, but it still enjoys both more support than essentially option number two among both populations. Option number two among Israeli Jews in polling would be one state in which Israel controls without Palestinians having the right to vote. And for Palestinians, option number two would be one state in which Palestinians do have the right to vote. Now, and that's growing among Palestinians. The discrepancy is diminishing, but it is still, you could say, the two-state solution has more support on both sides of the green line than anything else. And the third is, and part of that is that the Palestinian Authority and the PLO ostensibly support two states. And then, of course, the fourth question is the realities on the ground. Could you actually create a viable Palestinian state, how, given the fact that Israel has entrenched itself on the ground so much? I think that in the key thing that I would look at in the period to come is how the shift in Palestinian opinion from two states to one equal state, which is very much also along generational lines, right? Mahmoud Abbas's son supports one equal state. One of the things that's happened, which is really interesting, you see this if you look at the polling of Khalil Shikaki, the Palestinian prime minister, is the reason that Palestinians, younger Palestinians, are moving from supporting two states to one equal state is not only that they don't believe Israel will ever give them a state, but it's also because their experience with the Palestinian Authority and looking at the broader Arab world suggests that they're not even sure it would be a particularly appealing state anyway, in the sense that they're not, that we now live in a moment in history where the notion of a kind of another Mubarak state is not really appealing to Palestinians, to many younger Palestinians. If there is a shift that leads the PLO, which is the national representative of the Palestinian people, to itself say, we no longer support the two-state solution, we are going to move towards one equal state, I think that would be a game changer, because then it would not only be that it's very difficult logistically to try to imagine how you create a viable Palestinian state when you have such a deep Jewish settlement on the ground, but you would have the most aggrieved party, right, the party that is lacking rights, essentially saying we don't even want it. I think that would be the next key kind of moment in let's say we can't say that the Jews actually, if you in halakha we believe in life after death, right? We believe in the possibility of that life can that you can have even life after death. But I think that would be another key moment in I think the slow process of this becoming more and more untenable. And I think it's why you already see among Palestinian intellectuals, much more talk about one state. Among progressive Jewish intellectuals, like my friend Dalia Scheindlin, for instance, Bernard Avishai, you're seeing more talk about the idea of a confederation, which is two states, but two deeply integrated states, in which one might imagine that there would be Palestinian refugees who lived in Israel, but perhaps as citizens of a Palestinian state, and Jewish settlers who remained in Palestine, but as citizens of Israel. Mm.
Thank you.
Peter, I would like to ask a little bit about the response from the Jewish community. It seems like you're saying, there's a lot to lose, but it seems as though the more progressive Jews or the international community, mostly Europe, is talking against, the more power that Bibi Netanyahu and his voters have almost. I don't know if you see it as such, but what is happening with the Jewish community? Is it not a game? Does Netanyahu and his government, do they not consider us? I heard, for example, a British Jewish MP saying that today opposing annexation is not a matter of left versus right. It has become a consensus. And how is it in the States? Does it have a way to influence decision making in Israel? And more also important to ask, will there be any consequences to the Israel Jewish diaspora relations due to that decision?
Act. I mean, I can only speak for the United States, but in the United States, I think the harsh reality is that the most powerful institutions in organized American Jewry do not oppose annexation. Some of them may say that they oppose annexation, but they don't oppose annexation in any meaningful way, in the sense that they're actually willing to do anything significant about it. In fact, they are militantly opposed to the idea that there would be any consequences in any form for the U.S.-Israel relationship of annexation. And AIPAC, the most powerful American Jewish political organization, has said explicitly, we take no position, right? So there was this fiction which goes back 20 years now in kind of organized, established American Jewish discourse, that we want the two-state solution, but the Palestinians won't take it because they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. This has been the dominant discourse for 20 years. It turns out, and also that unilateral actions are unacceptable, right? The Palestinians can't do anything unilaterally. Any changes have to come as a result of negotiation, right? Because the Palestinians can't go to the UN because that's unilateral. And lo and behold, it turns out that when Israel takes an entirely unilateral decision to basically drive a nail into the coffin of the two-state solution by annexing parts of the West Bank, AIPAC and other American Jewish groups say, essentially, that's fine, it's not our position to take. So what's happened is the mask that American Jewry had any moral values, position of our own on this question has been essentially taken off, and we can see the reality. The reality is the position of organized American Jewry is that whatever Israel wants to do, Israel can do with our support, and it is not our position, nor should it not be the position of the American government to be able to challenge it. And I would simply say this. It was, annexation was quite unthinkable in a decade ago, even in some ways 5 years ago. I think it is time for us to ask the question seriously to the leaders of the organized American Jewish community. I don't know what the position in Britain is. If Israel were to take the position of moving towards transfer, the population expulsion, would our position also be that essentially it is Israel's decision to take whatever steps it wants and our government and we should take no position? Because I think the only natural lesson one can draw from the response to annexation is that we would act the same way, our leaders would act the same way if Israel moved towards transfer. Which I think, by the way, is not as unthinkable, sadly, in ways that I could go into as we might want to believe.
So the red line, what we saw, annexation.
There is no red line.
There used to be a red line, but it's always been pushed forward. Can we expect more from the Jewish community establishment? Because obviously the Israeli government is not the current government is not to expect on this too much.
I think the other thing that's really important that has happened in the United States was the victory of Joe Biden over Bernie Sanders. Sanders was challenging the dominant conversation. The analogies with Jeremy Corbyn in some ways are problematic because I don't think Sanders had some of the associations that Corbyn had that made Jews very uncomfortable. But on the question of the Israel conversation, Sanders was making it clear that he was going to put military aid on the table as a question of using military aid as a way to try to influence Israeli policy. Joe Biden was vehemently against that. If Sanders had won, he would have written that to some degree into the Democratic platform. It would have sent a message to Democrats across the board. And then I think the conversation would have been quite different because Netanyahu would have had to imagine a Sanders administration where there would have been a significant blowback for annexation. But with Joe Biden, I think Netanyahu doesn't have much to worry about. I think that Joe Biden in the Obama administration, as I've written about, was always in internal conversations against any significant public disagreement or pressure with Israel in the Obama administration. And I think the most likely thing, even though Biden is rhetorically against annexation, is that they would accept it as a fait accompli and essentially manage the situation.
Peter, if I could just follow that, and then soon we'll open up to questions because we've been getting quite a few interesting ones. On this theme, and I think you've alluded to it, is about the support in the diaspora amongst Jewish people, which is assumed to be constant. And could you say something about what appears to be, if not a contradiction, a tension, I think you called it, between the universal ideas some Jewish people have, many do, most do, maybe, outside Israel, versus nationalism? Do you think it's come to the point where it's fallen apart, or do you see signs of hope in maybe a crisis like this, which might bind it together, maybe have a positive effect of the diaspora on Israel? The context of that is that there's been lots of backlash to protests against annexation here in Britain, where people say you mustn't hang dirty linen in public, you mustn't suck our enemies, all these old-fashioned arguments. How do you reply to that and see a role?
So, you know, on the question of hanging dirty linen out, I've always chuckle when I hear that comment, since I wonder if the people who are concerned about Jews hanging dirty linen have actually ever read the Tanakh, you know, the Hebrew Bible, which seems to me is the greatest exercise in the hanging of Jewish dirty linen in human history, right? And in fact, it was used against us, right? I mean, if you read the martyrology section, for instance, of the liturgy on Yom Kippur, right? You were reminded that one of the things that the Roman emperor said to punish the martyrs was that actually no one had been punished for the sale of Yosef. Right, when Yosef was sold by his brother. So, but we have, I think, have a history of believing that speaking truth, even about ourselves, is actually part of our tradition, no matter who hears it. Right, and I think that should still be the case. On the question, the question of tribalism versus universalism is a crucial question. I think the creative tension between those two things is at the very core of what it means to be a Jew. After all, the Torah does not begin with Jews. Right, the first people we encounter in Torah are not Jews, right? Adam and Eve and Noah are not Jews, right? We don't really get to Jews until part of the a third or so into the way of the book of Bereishit, where we meet Abraham and his family, right? But then you have the move to a Jewish family, but you still have the notion of a universal messianic future and the notion that we have deep obligations towards all people. I think what has happened is that the creative tension, both in the diaspora and in Israel, between particularism and universalism. I am not a pure universalist. I believe that the central metaphor of the Jewish people is family, right? B'nai Israel, the children of Israel. We do have primary obligations to one another as a kind of imagined extended family, but those are not infinite. We also have their limits because we have obligations to all human beings. And what's happened, I think, the manifestation of the creative tension is a state that has particular obligations to Jews, but also gives the right of citizenship and the vote to every single person under its domain, which Israel tries to manage inside the Green Line and move forward on in 1956 when it ended military law for Arab Palestinian citizens. It's in the West Bank where that tension snaps because you have a Jewish state that only provides citizenship and the right to vote for Jews. And in the diaspora, what I fear is happening, again, I can only speak about the United States, is that we are seeing this massive fracturing where you have a large group, especially of younger American Jews, who, as you say, are deeply universal, but whose sense of Jewish identity and commitment and knowledge is thin. So the universalism, as laudable as it is not balanced by a thick sense of interconnectedness with the Jewish people around the world and with Jews across historical periods. And then you have another cohort, which in the American Jewish community, and particularly in the modern Orthodox community, in the Orthodox community in the United States, whose tribalism has completely overwhelmed its universalism, and whose sense of commitment to Am Yisrael has essentially blinded it to its moral obligations, particularly when Jews have power, as they do in Israel and to some degree in the United States, to those who are more less privileged than us. And so it's building that creative tension back that I think is part of the work for all of us to do.
Thank you. Peter, I want to go back to the question of two-state solution. We've been hearing that the two-state solution is dying since 67 or something, you know?
Right.
It's dying, and the death
right.
never arrives.
Right.
And I wonder, how does this death look, and does annexation change the reality? What should happen for the discourse to change? Should we change the discourse? You know, there I see two main camps around annexation. One that says we have to annex and to oppose annexation no matter what, and right. others who are looking also at the day after, kind of assuming right. that this will happen, and what should we do? Because speaking at the same language of two states in yeah. in the reality of annexation seems even more delusional. So,
right. So I've actually been working on a long essay that tries to think about some of these things, and I wish it were more fully formulated than it is. So I aspire to be more coherent. Later in the summer than I am on this now. I would just say a couple things. First of all, in terms of annexation, it's also very important to start with the recognition of what this means for people on the ground, for the most vulnerable people on the ground, for Palestinians in Area C, let's say, where that Israel may annex part or all of Area C. I think one of the problems I have with people who say, annexation, great, bring it on. Israel controls it anyway. It's just going to expose the reality of the two-state solution, is that the reality of life for those Palestinians in Area C, you know, several hundred thousand of them, is almost certainly going to get worse. They're already very, for instance, many Palestinians live in areas A or B, but have land in Area C. It's already quite difficult for them to get to that land now. If Israel annexes Area C, that may be it. They may completely lose their lands and their livelihoods. Travel from Palestinians, if it becomes impossible for them to cross through Area C because it's annexed, may also become, which is already nightmarish for many Palestinians to try to move across the archipelago of areas A and of A and B. But so these are really real world consequences. You know, it's not inconceivable at all that you could have Palestinians be physically removed from Area C. In fact, there was a poll that came out recently that showed that was the plurality view of Israeli Jews. What should happen to Palestinians in Area C? Move them to areas A and B, right? That's population transfer. So that's at the practical level. On the broader level, I would say the two-state solution is, at this point, very unrealistic. The one equal state is also very unrealistic. All options other than the status quo, which is Israeli control over all the territory between the Mediterranean and the Jordan, with Israel, with Palestinians in most of that territory lacking citizenship and basic rights. I'm accepting the Palestinian citizens of Israel from that, who have some rights. They have a right to vote. Nothing will be realistic to change that circumstance unless there is a shift in the balance of power. So it seems to me the crucial question for us to have is, how do we shift the balance of power, right? Frederick Douglass, the African-American leader, famously said, you know, power surrenders nothing without a demand. The crucial question is, how do we make that demand in a way that is ethical, that is nonviolent, that shows that is with love for Jews, not hatred for Jews, but makes that demand in a way that that can ethically channel Palestinian discontent and in a way that Israeli Jews can hear us.
Okay. Thank you for this. Yeah, Lawrence?
I'm just wondering, there's so many questions that are appearing.
Yeah, maybe we can start with questions. So if you have questions based on everything that Peter spoke about or beyond, please pose it, please write it in the chat. Maybe we can start with our friend Ian Black to ask his question. So Ian, hello, good evening. I'm going to unmute you. I need help with unmuting. Yeah, now you're good.
Hi. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, perfect.
Yes.
Hi. Peter, pleasure to see you in a virtual way. I wanted to ask whether, you've touched on it already. There's obviously going to be a significant degree of overlap between questions, but I want you to you talked about those who say bring it on, annexation will clarify things and so on and so forth, and you talked a little bit about the practical consequences of that, particularly with Palestinians who live in Area C of the West Bank. But I want to fast forward, if you like, to the question, those who say bring annexation on want to no longer waste their time and effort on the issue of dealing with occupation. They say let's move on from that and let's talk about equal rights, so Israel becomes to all intents and purposes an equivalent of apartheid era South Africa, and I understand that argument, but what I don't understand is that, do you know anybody who has a workable strategy, an achievable strategy on that basis for achieving equal rights for Jews and Palestinians between the river and the sea? That I don't see, but I'm curious to hear your response to that it seems to me, very, very important question. Thank you.
Sure. And it's a pleasure to meet you virtually. I admire your work. It's a difficult question. I guess there are two ways of thinking about it. First of all, are there people who have a vision for the end state, for what one state might look like? To some degree, yes, there are. Again, you have, I would say, a range. You have on the Jewish kind of liberal left, you have the people who come around to the idea of confederation, which is two states, but two kind of deeply integrated states. You have a lot of Palestinian writing about one state. I mean, you can go back to look at Edward Said writing in 1999. Ali Abu Nima wrote a book in 2007. I mean, many Palestinian intellectuals have written about this at the level of principle. I think, and then there's a set of, the challenge with one of the challenges in this is that Palestinians in particular are very enamored of the South Africa analogy. And there are various reasons that I think the South Africa analogy is problematic, but one of them is that South Africa was not a binational state, right? South Africa did contain one coherent nationality of South Africanness, despite the apartheid government's best effort through the creation of homelands and other things to essentially bifurcate South African identity along tribal and racial lines. So if one is thinking about one equal state would look like in Israel-Palestine, you can't really look at post-apartheid South Africa primarily, because although it has strong guarantees for individual constitutional rights, it doesn't have guarantees for national rights. I think the most interesting proposals in this regard about what a state, you know, Ahmed Tibi has called for a state of all its nationality, which is the idea that you would have protections for national rights as well as individual rights. I think some of the proposals that have come from Arab Palestinian activists inside the Green Line might actually be some interesting models for what you might think about between Israel, Palestine, the entire area. And you also have other places like Northern Ireland, Belgium, which have had to deal with the questions of binationalism. That's separate from the question of how you would, even if one did believe these things were plausible. And again, I'm going to remain really agnostic on this because I've really devoted the summer to really trying to actually delve into this and try to come to some sense of it for myself. But there's the question of how you would even get in that place, right? And I guess the point I was trying to make earlier is, in some ways, regardless of what your end state is, whether you want traditional two-state solution, confederation, some kind of federated democratic binational state, the central question is really, how do you change the balance of power in an ethical way? And I do think that one crucial question that only Palestinians can answer, which I think you're alluding to, is where is their national movement going to go, particularly as it relates to the Palestinian Authority? The Palestinian Authority makes it much easier for Israel to control the West Bank. Ironically, even Hamas has become a kind of subcontractor of Israeli control in Gaza, also making it much easier for Israel essentially to control these territories. But the PA also provides economic sustenance for Palestinians and some degree of order. If Palestinians get rid of the Palestinian Authority, that will be a game changer, not only because it will end the fiction of a Palestinian state in waiting, but because it'll dramatically raise the cost of occupation in ways that change the political discourse in Israel significantly, right? So I think that what, in some ways, the dog that really has not barked here fundamentally is the actions by the Palestinian national movement in terms of their own decision to essentially take actions that are going to make the status quo harder to maintain.
We seem to have, there's a question, perhaps I'll just get, I see Jamal Saad, who I know, he's got a question to which there's already been answers on the alternative meeting which is going on in the group chat. It's the contentious issue, I think, and Sahel Nasser also agrees with him. Sahel was asking about the borders of the state of Israel, where's it going to end up? And maybe I'll ask Jamal to ask his question. I should just put on the record that Joshua Greenberg has written quite a bit of interest in opposition to what Jamal was saying. So I'll ask Jamal, do you want to put your question?
Hi, thank you so much. For me, as a Palestinian, I think grow up in a refugee camp, I think the annexation is just another chapter of Israeli colonial project of Palestine and the continuation of the Zionist project. And again, it's exposing Israel to the whole world that it's never been interested in peace. And they're rather interested in getting rid of the Palestinians, stealing more land, and making the Palestinian life even harder. So do you agree, and why?
So I guess first I want to say thank you for being on the call. I mean, I think one of the crucial things that doesn't happen, certainly in the United States, nearly enough, is that, frankly, when you have Jewish speakers on this subject, there are usually very few Palestinians, and very much the reverse. Palestinian speakers, there are very few Jews. So, you know, it says in Pirkei Avot in the Mishnah, you know, who is wise? The one who learns from all people. So I have tremendous admiration for anybody who crosses those ethno-national and ideological divides. And to Josh or whoever it is who's saying that, you know, who's Joshua Greenberg, who thinks that everybody here are crazy, self-hating left-wingers, I would say, kol hakavod to you for being on this call. Because I deeply admire people who are willing to go and listen to people who they disagree with. I think that your depiction of Israel from a Palestinian perspective is entirely understandable. I have little doubt that were I Palestinian, I would agree. And I think there are major elements of truth in it. But I also think it's really important, as difficult as it is for Palestinians, given all of the suffering that Palestinians have had, for Palestinians to try to understand the way the story looks from inside the Jewish family, from inside the Jewish, from the narrative of Jewish history, not for all Jews, but for many Jews, which is that it is not made up that during morning Shacharit every morning for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, Jews around the world have prayed for a return to Israel. This is not a fiction, right? The Jewish sense of ourselves as coming from this land and desiring return is deeply rooted in the Jewish story. And so while it's understandable that it looks colonial from the outside, and objectively, yes, it has certain colonial features, right? Largely European population, at least until the Mizrahi Jews start coming in the late 40s and 50s, supported to some degree by European colonial powers, coming and taking control. Yes, these are colonial elements, and yet if you want to speak to Jews in a way that they're going to be able to hear, you have to understand that for us, it feels genuinely like a homecoming to some degree. And I think this is why it's so important, even though it's so difficult, for Palestinians to accept the idea of Jews as natives to the land. Now, that doesn't mean that Jews have the right to have, doesn't mean that Jews should have rights that Palestinians don't have. It doesn't mean that Palestinians should give up on the demand for equality. But I do think that one can say, I think in some ways what Jews want from Palestinians most of all is to say, welcome home, we accept you in this part of the world. And Palestinians cannot be expected to do that without their rights, without their freedom, without equality. But I think what we need to do is try to move towards both of us being able to have that conversation, where Jews say, yes, Palestinians have a human right towards equality. And Palestinians say, you have the right to be here. You are not interlopers here.
Thanks for this. Yeah, and thanks for Palestinians who came to be part of this call, obviously. I would like to let the next question be asked by Shaked Moag. We're honored to have you in this discussion, the director of Peace Now in Israel and also former acting secretary general of Meretz in Israel. So, Shaked, over to you.
Hey, hi, good evening, everybody. I'm very happy to be here and very excited to see how well people outside of Israel are involved and feel attached to our struggle. And I must say, this is a struggle. We are seeing ourselves at the moment at the very, I wouldn't say even beginning, we're already in the struggle. And we see annexation as something that needs to be prevented. And I wonder, Peter, and something that I see inside the entire peace camp in Israel, whether the, let me say this, annexation is unilateral and it is aimed at perpetuating a situation that happened during 53 years of occupation. And it's not the formation of a new one state. It is something else. And isn't it irresponsible to discuss a post-two-state solution situation instead of devoting all efforts to condemn annexation as a step that closes the window of opportunities for a two-state solution, which is the only viable solution that allows both people to have their nation states and live in equality and have their rights? And maybe it's a semi-question that follows. I see annexation as not as, as like might close the window, but it doesn't mean it will not reopen. We still struggle for two capitals in Jerusalem, although East Jerusalem was already annexed according to Israeli law, but we still believe it can be returned to Palestinians and serve as their capital, and therefore isn't annexation still something that can and needs to be reversed even after it happens?
Right, right. So this is an odd webinar in the sense that I keep being asked questions by people who know more about this than I do, which is unusual and a little bit intimidating. But I guess I would say I don't think that one should by any means embrace and support annexation. And yes, if there is the political will, things could be unannexed. I think again, which is why I think one of the really critical questions is what happens to the Palestinian national movement in the coming years? Does it keep asking for two states or not? I think though that where I might just slightly disagree is even if one supports two states, still supports two states, I think one can imagine the political value of there being people out there talking about one equal state, which is to say, if part of what needs to happen is there needs to be pressure on Israel to realize that the status quo is not going to lead Israel to a good place. That in some ways, I think the prospect of people talking about one equal state might encourage some Israelis to be more, take a different view of the two-state solution, which is to say that maybe the Palestinian demand for one state leads Israel to recognize that actually what Palestinians have long said is true, which is that Israel needs the two-state solution in some ways as much or more than Palestinians do. So I think what we have to do is try to think about ways of making Israeli leaders and the Israeli Jewish population think anew, changing their incentive structure. Because what we've seen is that in election after election, essentially Israeli Jews have essentially ratified the status quo. And so I am open to thinking about a whole range of things as long as they are nonviolent, as long as they speak in the language of human dignity, that would try to change that calculation within Israel.
We've got little time, I believe, and quite a few questions. So maybe we could line up three questions, just keep it short if possible. I see Mr. France is saying... France, sorry, are you there?
Apologies. Steve France.
Yes, maybe.
Oh, okay, yeah, there you are. He can talk. Yeah, you can talk.
Right. Steve France and then Sana Kanane. Maybe a quick question, and maybe Joshua as well, seeing as if he wants to make a quick comment. Would that be acceptable? I think so. Okay, Steve.
Yes. Oh, well, thank you very much. I was intrigued by Peter's definition of the essence of what Israel is about and what his form of Zionism is about, is that the Jews are a family. And Well, family is a nice thing, although it is a mafia term as well. So never quite know what you're going to get. But it seems like the big issue is, why must this family be a political family that runs a state, a nation state, in a world where we don't have ethnic, we don't really accept that there are ethnic or religious states anymore. Why can't, and furthermore, I mean, rabbinical Judaism said that no to political anything, right? I mean, political Zionism is wrong. It's, they spent, 1800 years or something of like, no, we have an exile. we are in relationship with God about that exile. And it has to do with our holiness and our ethics, and everything. And so Herzl just, he had nothing to do with that. And it seems like, I don't know where this family thing comes from. It seems sort of cobbled. But anyway, enough from me.
Okay, thank you.
You want to get to all the questions in and then have me answer all of them?
I think so. Okay. We'll try that approach. Okay. Should I call on Sana? Sana, you there?
Yes. Thank you, Lawrence. Can you hear me? Yes.
Yep.
Yes, so allow me, please, I just want to correct what Shaked said. It has been 72 years of occupation and not 53. And if our allies on the Zionist left are going to change our narrative and our story, I think we need to revisit our alliance and our partnership and whom we want to be in partnership with. Now, to my question, to Peter, you have mentioned Jewishness and Jewish values, which I think it might be a good way to tap into the moral part of how where Israel is going to and how the Jewish diaspora is dealing with the annexation, with the possible annexation. My question to you is, we the Palestinians, the Palestinian political activist or foreign policy expert, who want to do advocacy and engage with the Jewish community, do you think we should rather work and ally with the U.S. Jews, the American Jews, because they are more progressive in criticizing Israel, and the U.S. is anyways a more important player in this than the U.K., and because the British Jews are very British in that sense. And it's not because of their Jewishness, but their Britishness, that they're not really able to criticize Israel and hold it accountable to what it's doing. And we want to have alliance that is able to stand up to the wrongdoings of Israel. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And unmute. No. And Joshua, do you want to give a quick comment and or question? I think preferably a question if you can. And then does that work for you, Peter?
Sure, yeah.
Great. Okay. Joshua?
Ooh. Maybe we can let Karen ask her question. Karen Shapiro?
Sure. Okay.
That's Karen from PPI. Can you unmute her?
Thank you, Matan. Thank you, Lawrence. And thank you, Peter, for being here. I'm an optimist, and I cannot yet give up on working towards stopping annexation. I think Biden could be a key to that. But do you think there is anything that can be done where we could get him to speak out about this and oppose annexation? Because I think that could be a key. And is there anything else you believe that can be done that would stop annexation from happening?
Great, should I try to respond to those three?
Yes, please.
Sure, so I guess to start with Steve, I mean, I don't think that the metaphor of family is artificial. I think it flows quite naturally from the reading of the first two books of the Torah, which is essentially to say the story of Genesis of Bereshit is the story of the creation and trials and tribulations of a family. And then in Shemot and Exodus, that family becomes a nation. The children of Israel become Am Yisrael. The first time you see that phrase is in Shemot, in nation. I think it's extremely significant that the Jewish nation is born in slavery. And it's something we need to always remind ourselves of and think about why it was that our text would have us be born in slavery and what that says about our ethical obligation. nations in the world. You were entirely right. The position after the Bar Kokhba rebellion becomes essentially the three principles in Gemara that you basically, that there will be no return to the land of Israel until messianic time. I think that was reconsidered for some fairly good reasons starting in the late 19th century. And to me, the central question that one could ask is, as a Zionist, for me, the question I ask is, what is essential? I believe it is essential. It is certainly essential now that there be a thriving and safe Jewish community, society in the land of Israel that can radiate throughout the Jewish world as Echad Ha'am imagined, right? Just think about the recreation of Hebrew as a living language and how significant that has been, right? The question one might have to ask at certain point, if one gives up on the two-state solution, is does that Jewish home, that Jewish society have to also include a Jewish state, right? There were many early Zionists who actually thought about Jewish national self-determination in ways that did not require sovereignty. For instance, as an autonomous district in the Ottoman Empire, right? So this is a conversation that one could start to think about with some genuine trepidation on my part. This is not where I have wanted to be, but again, we have to respond to events as difficult as they are and painful. Sana, to your question, I don't know if American Jews have any advantages over British Jews. I don't think most Americans these days feel like we have many advantages over anyone, to be honest about it. But I guess, and it is not really my place to instruct Palestinians on what to do, but I would just say, given my own experience, I would just say this. When Palestinians tell their story on a human level, simply tell the story of their family, what has happened to their family. In my experience, that is enormously powerful. And it is enormously powerful for Jewish audiences because Jewish families know the story of historical dispossession and dispersion and what it means to be at the mercy of powers greater than yourself and what it means at a human level. And so I would just encourage Palestinians, when they have the opportunity, to Jewish audiences, to tell your own personal story as much as possible, because I think it penetrates often beneath what is some of the kind of hasbara, kind of talking point stuff, and touches people deeply in a way that can penetrate. In terms of Karen's question, I think what pressure could still be mounted? Look, I think that the one thing that could happen would be that the forces around Bernie Sanders, who will have a significant number of delegates at the convention, could try to use that influence with the Biden campaign to try to write into the platform a series of tougher statements on annexation than Biden has made so far. Unfortunately, so far, Bernie Sanders has essentially decided to use his leverage to try to move Biden to the left on domestic issues, not really on foreign policy, which I think is unfortunate. The problem we have is that Biden basically feels that progressives, including progressive Jews, have nowhere to go. He can take them for granted. What are they going to do, vote for Donald Trump? Right? So he doesn't feel any pressure essentially to move from the position he's in, which is the kind of the safe position, which doesn't alienate, you know, kind of APAC people who might be willing to vote for him. And that's going to be very difficult. But we are in a moment of mass and unpredictable grassroots protest in the United States and deep, deep, deep dissatisfaction and a growing radicalism on a whole range of issues. So it may be possible that some of that can start to influence the Israel-Palestine conversation too.
So we have, thank you. We have two more questions. So we have a question from Paul about confederation, speaking about a different paradigm. There needs to be a different paradigm, but what is it? Paul?
Okay, thank you, and thank you, Peter, for appearing. You actually answered this just after I wrote the question, but do you, I had asked whether confederation might be a reasonable or a possible alternative to two-state, And I wonder if you see that as pie in the sky or as something that in a generation could possibly develop the sense of trust on both sides. I see it as the only alternative to one and two states, if two states is genuinely unattainable.
Thank you very much. If we can, Peter, can we take two questions?
Sure.
Yeah, so we have an interesting question from Amy Nachshon. Amy?
Ami. Yeah. Ami.
Ami. Oh,
Slicha. And Baya. And Baya. Oh,
sorry,
hi, Peter.
Sorry, Slicha. Slicha.
Slicha.
You know, I'm one of those neurotic, progressive American pro-Israel Jews who has managed until now to sort of oppose BDS, even though I can understand boycott of settlement-made product. In a post-annexation world, How do we fight BDS anymore?
Right. Okay. I'll start with that. The answer I would say is that I don't think that what progressive Jews should be doing is certainly not in a post-annexation world, is fighting BDS. That doesn't mean I support BDS. I don't support BDS. There are reasons that I don't support BDS that are intellectual, and there are reasons that I don't support BDS that are Kishka gut reasons, that it would be foolish for me to pretend that these things are not, that these entirely are an operation of mental and the head. It would be extremely, extremely difficult for me at a personal level to boycott the state of Israel, period. But that said, we have a finite amount of time and a finite amount of energy and resources, right? So the question is, does fighting the BDS movement, right, which is after all a nonviolent movement that speaks in the language of human rights and international law, right? Not a violent movement, not an Islamist movement, right? Is that the best use of our resources? No, I don't think it's the best use of our resources. I think the best use of our resources is to try to change our own communities and to try to think about the forms of ethical, nonviolent, loving pressure that we feel comfortable with and that we can rally people in our community towards, right? That we can start to move, and that's why I wrote a piece last year talking about military aid, which was not a bridge that I had wanted to cross before, but that I began to think that one could make a credible argument that there could be ways of conditioning military aid that didn't threaten Israeli security but created pressure. So I guess that would be my answer. On the question of confederation. I think confederation is pie in the sky now, as is the classic two-state solution, as is one equal state. They're all pie in the sky, right? The only thing that's not pie in the sky is Israel controlling all the land. So the question I think really is, if we were to be able to change the situation on the ground, right, so that there was a very different political debate in Israel because the incentive structures were different, at that point, might it become a more viable option? And I think the answer is perhaps yes. I mean, Dalia Scheinlein has done a lot of polling on this. Khalil Shakaki has done polling. It may be that the idea of being able to say that you will have a united Jerusalem in which people can move freely and that settlers will be able to stay, although again, complicated because it's not like they can stay in exclusive communities. There, you know, Palestinians will need to be able to move into Male Adumim. And there will also have to be compensation and a legal process for land that was stolen. And the idea that Palestinian refugees will be able to move and live inside Israel. Again, the question of Will Israel be able to impose limitations on that? Will they have only Palestinian residents? What a citizenship? What does it mean to live inside Israel with Palestinian citizenship? These are all very complicated questions, but I do think it's possible to imagine a situation where in which confederation becomes more more possible, has more public support, and is more viable on the ground than the traditional two-state solution, which imagines more a kind of separation.
Okay, we have maybe one last question. It's a little bit a statement. So, Azriel, if you can make it as a question and not a statement, please, and then.
We have a bit of time, but Azriel.
Azriel, yeah.
Okay, I wanted to say, is there, if we want to try and be positive, is it possible that we're just, you know, maybe worrying unnecessarily? Maybe this whole annexation thing is not going to happen. Maybe it already appears that it's sort of been pushed into the long grass, so to speak, because the settlers themselves are up in arms about it. It seems that the Trump administration itself is cooling down on it. Also, why does Bibi need it? I mean, let's be honest, he's done very well to push the Palestinian issue off the agenda. This is bringing the Palestinian issue back on the agenda big time. I mean, there's no logic to it. Maybe this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Peter, very much for a really, really enjoyable discussion. But I'd like to think that this is all ultimately won't matter because it's not going to happen. But perhaps I'm being over-optimistic.
Look, I think everything you're... Oh, should I answer this or do we want to have get more questions in, Lawrence? What should we do?
I think maybe answer this one. We'll just...
Okay.
Yeah, and then we'll see... Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Azriel, I think everything you say is entirely logical. And I think the question, particularly of, you know, of settler opposition is a really interesting dynamic. I would say that, you know, if I were, you know, I think the logical thing, for, as I said at the beginning, for people who want to create as much Israeli control on the ground with as little opposition as possible, would be to continue the de facto annexation that has been going on for many years, rather than making it de jure. But I will also say that there is a tendency for governments, when they feel in positions of enormous power, to overplay their hand. Again, you know, we in the United States have had a good set of experiences with that over the last 20 years. And I do think there have been other examples of Israel doing things in recent years that are not smart from their own perspective, but in, you know, some of the moves to kind of crack down on dissent internally, for instance, even, you know, which undermine Israel's ability to cast itself as this liberal democracy. And I think that it's possible that Netanyahu may overreach. Again, also Netanyahu, as you know, Azriel, has a deep sense of himself as a world historical figure, right? A man who's going to go down in history, a kind of like this era's Churchill and Jabotinsky rolled into one. And I think he may feel that part of his grand historical legacy, again, as someone who has always, I think, genuinely and deeply opposed the two-state solution, as his father did, would be to be the person who essentially makes this historically momentous move. And so that might be something that I think would undermine perhaps what I think is the quite convincing logic that you lay out.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a question from Joshua Greenberg. Joshua?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Hi, Joshua.
Yes. Question. I'd just like to apologize for calling. I don't know who it was, an anti-Semite. I meant it was an anti-Semite. And hi Peter.
Hi.
How you doing?
It's an honor to meet you, Peter. Like, I've been a huge the crisis of Zionism turned me from an anti-Zionist to a Zionist, and now I'm kind of post because I'm confused, because I'm very worried, I'm very weary that Israel is about to kill the two-state solution with annexation, and I want to know what to do. So I'm a member of, if not now, I've just kind of I just attended a strategy meeting this week actually. And I was inspired by what you said in previous statements that we need to begin leveraging aid to Israel or have it as a consequence for annexation. And as a Zionist, I don't even know what I am anymore now. I'm also a rabbinical student. So there's all these other complicated matters as well. And I told Lawrence that I would reach out to I forgot his name after the session. But my questions, those are my three questions. So what are the consequences for Israel if they annex the West Bank? How does the two-state solution survive with annexation? And do you think it is important for U.S. Jews to ally themselves with JVP, and if not now, that do not take a stance on Zionism or statehood?
So, are we still doing one at a time, Lawrence, or is that...
I think so, because there are three questions there. You managed to get three in, so...
Okay.
I think in this case...
Some of it I think we've already dealt with a little bit, but I guess I want to try to take off on what you said to follow up on something we were saying before. I think that the conversation about Zionism versus anti-Zionism is not a particularly interesting conversation. To me, the much more important conversation for American Jews to be having, and I think here, a organization like If Not Now, which I see as really inspiring and gives me great hope, is to start cultivating a conversation about what Zionism is, about the varieties of Zionism, about its historical strands, and about how those strands can be imagined or reformulated in different ways in this different reality. I think one of the things that's really important, and I would recommend here Dmitry Shumsky's book, Beyond the Nation State, is that Zionism has evolved over time in response to different historical circumstances, and its set of its demands changed. And so I think the crucial question for us to ask is, What is most important for us? For me, I will say, it is not the state per se. Now, I have supported a Jewish state, but it is not the reason that when I go to Israel, although I feel a complicated set of emotions because I know the pain and oppression of Palestinians, I also feel a deep, deep sense of pride and connection. And what fills me with that sense of pride and connection is not the Jewish state, it's the Jewish society, right? It's seeing Jews from every corner of the world speaking Hebrew, interacting with one another, blending the old and the new, the street signs that echo throughout Jewish history as one walks through the streets of Israel. It's the Jewish society. It's the sense that even though I don't live there, that there is something of a Jewish home here, that there is halacha that can only be practiced in the land of Israel, that there are cultural creation that can only be created in the land of Israel. We need to think about, to me, that's the unnegotiable, rock solid reality that has to exist. The political formations, then, one can have a conversation about within a Zionist context. And that's, I think, the work that we really need to start to have. We have this bizarre situation in the United States now where Zionism is a red line for entrance into the organized American Jewish community. And yet Zionism is really not ever defined, nor is there an interesting conversation about what it is. But I often imagine if Achad Ha'am were to be reincarnated, right, a cultural Zionist who did not believe in statehood and wanted to speak at Hillel, would they say no? Because you're not a Zionist, because you don't believe in a Jewish state? Right, that's the conversation I think we need to have.
Thank you very much. We have two questions. A last recent one from Orna, and another one from Yechezkel Landau. Orna, let me unmute you. Just a second. Yeah.
Good evening. Thank you, Matan. Thank you, Peter, and everybody. Sorry for joining this lecture late. I wanted to ask if Meretz UK and Meretz at all thinks it can take a role in influencing Britain and Europe in taking an active role against this. This step of the Israeli government, which is done officially, because the Trump sovereignty is probably going off on November. We all hope it will. So if this is the reason, as long as there's a more more positive and more more smart government in England, why we shouldn't take an opportunity and pressing as long as Britain is governed by a sane prime minister and not by another lunatic, not to influence him to take a role in this event.
So this question is for Lawrence and myself, yeah. Or Lawrence, do you want to start?
I'm sorry, I was a bit distracted. Why did you start? Sorry.
Okay, I start, no problem. So, you know, Merits UK, we give a platform in support of Merits, which is a Zionist anti-occupation political party in Israel. But nevertheless, it's shrinking in Israel. That's the unfortunate reality that we're in. By the way, this might change. We saw in the past how Tzipi Livni and Kadima, you know, maybe black, maybe Gantz and blue and white will be just a very short episode. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. And also, I turn this to you, Peter, as a question to speak about the political reality in Israel in a post-annexation, what differences can be. But as I see it myself, I think that we do have a right to also lobby as Jews who support Meretz and support a democratic Israel that doesn't occupy and that doesn't perpetuate the occupation by annexation. We do have a right to lobby to European governments and to our government here in the UK and ask, you know, for any type of consequences, because condemnations have not helped so far. And it is I think it is it's a very legitimate and peaceful tool. So my answer is yes. What we see, by the way, in the Jewish community, and maybe Peter, you can say give the parallel in the U.S. It feels like there's a lot of consensus about opposing occupation, the annexation, sorry, but not towards but not lobbying the government yet, but rather senior rabbis and Jewish leaders trying to change the approach of the establishment of the Board of Deputies. So if that can also, if this voice can also be a Jewish voice that backs, you know, not just condemnation, but, you know, accountability for what our country, what Israel is doing, then my answer is yes. I don't know if you have anything to add, Lawrence.
Hi, can you hear me? Yes. There we go. As you can see, I'm a novice. Even on my birthday resolution is to learn how to use Zoom. Next time. Okay. Well, broadly to your question, I think rather adding to what Matan said, I think there's opportunity at the time now where whenever somebody wants to stand up and make a statement because they're outraged or because they're angry or they want to passionately explain why they want to be pro-Israel, pro-peace, Jewish, and so forth, they don't know where the one address is, and is the one address. So I think one phenomenon that seems to be developing are joint letters, and such as one we signed with the JLM and also Mazzotti and Reform, about a particular issue within the Board of Deputies, where they essentially suggested, I don't want to mischaracterize, but they were saying we shouldn't really speak out on annexation. The argument against that was, I say, we shouldn't speak about political events. But just 6 months before, the Board of Deputies, which has a range of opinion as well, actually said we support a two-state solution. So the basic logical loop that one has to, the Gordian knot one has to cut, is to find out how can you have annexation and a two-state solution? Where's the state going to be? So it's on those points that one can make. statement. My tone is also reaching out, I shouldn't say too much, but to many Labour and other MPs in Parliament. But I'd love to continue that conversation with you. If you're interested, you're welcome to contact us. We'd love to take that forward and discuss real, practical moves that one can do. Again, the final point is, here we are in the Galut, as it were, the diaspora, we are that much distance from events on the ground in Israel, but I think we have every right, and we've got an obligation to speak out when something is done in our name. I'm speaking as a Jewish person. There is only one state of Israel, and in a sense, both left-wing and right-wing people can agree it should be the best. If it's going to be a state for Jews in a way, or a Jewish state in some ways, then make it the best, the most moral one you can. Otherwise, all those other words like apartheid and so forth will gain traction. So, do we have other?
I hope that answers. Peter, do you have anything?
No. Let's go to more questions, I think.
Okay.
Okay. I see Laura Libin has a question. Laura?
Laura Libin. Yeah.
Sorry. I wrote it in the chat. It's just that I'm also interested in the question of how Jewish society that Peter was talking about would actually be able to continue over time, you know, due to intermarriage and whatever else, without an actual state. That's my
right.
question.
Yeah. So I don't have an answer to that. Again, these are I have been. For 10 years, since I really started writing about this, I have been kind of devoting my time to trying to argue for the merits of a two-state solution and for the notion of a Jewish state that provided the right of citizenship to everyone under its control, and of the necessity of Palestinian human rights and the idea of territorial compromise. So I have not given up on that framework. I do think that. I am trying to think about the world that might exist on the other side of that if we get to a place where there is no choice. I am not there yet, and I have not certainly not worked out my thoughts about it. Again, this is essentially kind of part of the project that I'm working on now. But I can say that. It is very important that if we're going to support the two-state solution, that we are actually supporting it in a way that actually is trying to bring pressure for actual change, because the two-state solution has been for too long, certainly in the American Jewish community, and I fear especially now anti-annexation, essentially a kind of a way of pretending to want change when in fact one is actually doing everything, when one is actually in support of the status quo. And I think that's what's really kind of untenable. And so I think that's the position that we have to be very careful not to allow ourselves to fall into, and that we have to challenge people who I think have been playing that role.
Okay.
Hi, Yeheskel, did you ask your question? I don't think you did. No. Ah, okay. There we go.
Ah, thank you so much. Shalom to everybody. Peter, thank you very much for all you do and everything you've said here, which I agree with. Coming from the religious Zionist left, I was directing the Oz V'Shalom, Netivot Shalom movement in Israel in the 1980s. I'm a dual citizen now based in Connecticut in the US. Here's the question, partly for American Jews, but also those on the Israeli left, what's left of the left. Do you think that Benny Gantz and Gabi Ashkenazi can be a sufficiently strong bulwark against the efforts of even partial annexation? That's number one. And can the American Jewish establishment at least use them as a basis to oppose Bibi? And do you think that the criminal charges and the trial of the prime minister will give diaspora Jews a stronger basis of opposing him and his policies, if even if people in Israel can't oust him.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's an honor to meet you, Yechezkel. I followed your work, and I suspect you could probably answer these questions at least as well as I could. I'm not a dual citizen, but I guess I would just say I think what I've seen from Benny Gantz so far does not fill me with a lot of hope. I think that to me, his unwillingness to when the joint list took and Ayman Odeh took a tremendous risk in endorsing him, right? I mean, putting themselves at political risk by endorsing someone whose politics are very, very far from their own and who was not really even much of a supporter of the two-state solution. And then he did not reciprocate and then went into alliance with Bibi. I think what he did is he reified a set of assumptions in Israel, which are very much deeply part of the problem, which is to say, as long as the functioning assumption in Israeli politics is you have to get your Knesset majority with Jewish seats only, because Palestinians, Arab Palestinian citizens cannot be part of a coalition government. Now, to be clear, it's not easy for Palestinians to be part of a coalition government. It's not entirely clear that all the political parties, particularly something like Balad, would agree anyway, right? But when essentially starting from your position that basically you're not even going to consider them as legitimate members of the Knesset for the purpose of getting 61 seats, I think is part of what has really killed the Israeli left. I mean, you know, a Jewish left alone is simply not numerically strong enough. I mean, it's a crude analogy, but it's like you think the Democratic Party could win without African American votes, right? These are the people who have the strongest interest in the values of equality that the left is supposed to represent. You can't keep them out. And so I think that was a tragic mistake by Benny Gantz. And to me, it's been kind of downhill since then. So I'm not terribly optimistic. And I don't think that the American Jewish community is going to, first of all, as you know, American Jews and otherwise are deeply right now inward looking, right? I mean, we're an inward looking bunch in the best of times. And now we're completely consumed by the trauma and chaos in our own society and sense of failure. So I think that makes it harder. But I also think that the truth is that we have an organized Jewish establishment that is representative of a small, disproportionately older, disproportionately religious Orthodox, and particularly largely oligarchic Jewish population, in which as Jews have assimilated, the MASH support membership of many Jewish organizations has dwindled, and more Jewish organizations are sustained by very small numbers of very, very large donors who wield disproportionate influence. And those people don't have any interest in they're ideologically right-wing, but they also have a personal interest in being on good terms with Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. And that is the way our community's agenda has been set. So I'm afraid I don't see any short-term change in that.
I think we have a few last quick questions before we come to an end. Frank Brodsky. Frank?
Yeah, so I'm here. So okay. I think that Wara kind of followed up on my question, and so I'm not sure if there's more to say, but you know, specifically, Peter, you were talking about your Zionism not being tied to the state, but more being tied to the peoplehood. And again, my concern about that is, you know, if the state ceases to exist, what happens to the Jewish people over time from a threat standpoint? And so yeah. You kind of alluded to that with Laura's follow-up question, but I'm hoping you can comment further.
Yes, I think obviously a supremely important question and conversation not one that can be thought taken lightly or kind of responded to casually. All I would say is that I think that it is one, we may get to a place where we have to start asking those questions. That is not to say that there are good answers to those questions, right? And this is something that I myself have been really kind of wrestling with and trying to research and think about. I think that obviously a Jewish society in the land of Israel to thrive and to perform the role that people like the Chacham wanted to perform, it has to be safe. It has to have security. That's a precondition for anything else. But I also think that it's not an acceptable place to be to essentially make peace with the notion of millions of Palestinians being permanent non-citizens in the country in which they live. So this, I hope that maybe in some future conversation we can delve into this more deeply, but I'm gonna kind of leave it at that because this is really a subject that I am starting to try to think about, but I have more questions than answers.
So I think that we answered many questions. We did cover a wide spectrum of themes this evening, and seeing many people involved in so many Jewish people, leaders, rabbis speaking out more than they have before. We can see that annexation is a threat, a crystal clear threat, but it's also an opportunity for having more people supporting a two-state solution that's real and not just out there. Peter, you spoke about the Confederation, the two states, and the one state being a pie in the sky. And what we have on the ground is Israeli annexation, perpetuation of the occupation. We need to have something positive for the future. We need something to cling on to for our activism, for all the Jews who believe and Israelis who believe in what Meretz believes, the two-state solution. Democratic and Jewish Israel, what can we do?
Look, I would say for me, as someone who does not live in Israel-Palestine, who lives here in the United States, for me, my action on this issue is an act of solidarity with the people on the ground who inspire me and who I admire and who have suffered and put much more at stake than I do, right? From my friend Youssef Munayar in Hebron, who has been jailed and beaten by both the Palestinian Authority and Israel, who still preaches, who has convinced people not to stab Israeli settlers, even though the Israeli settlers near him make his life virtually unlivable. It's in solidarity with him, with the young Palestinian who recently was in touch with me and talked about how he had taken some of the people in his village to go to Yad Vashem, to try to understand the Israeli Jewish perspective, even though he's been so traumatized by what Israel has done to his family. To the Jewish activists who speak in an authentically Jewish language and bring to me the language of the prophets alive in the land of Israel by following in their footsteps and speaking a language of justice in the face of power. And there are many, many of those people who have had the good fortune to know. To me, I guess my basic view is when they give up. I said Yusuf. My apologies. I meant Isa Amro. I don't know why I said that. I said Yusuf. I was thinking about Isa Amro. To me, when those people give up, then it's successful for us to give up, right? When they are still struggling for a vision of justice. And a vision of a set of, in the case of Jews, a set of Jewish ideals that I think is the best of our traditions, again, as a people that was born in slavery for a reason, then we give up. Before that point, we don't.
Yeah, that's definitely inspiring. So thank you so much, Peter, for being with us. I don't know if, Florence, you have any things to say. You are on mute. But I want to thank everyone who came. I want to thank PPI for co-hosting this meeting. It's not a webinar. We are all here. We see each other. That's how the discussion should be. Lawrence?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Matan. Thank you so much, Peter. It was really, I can speak personally, but I think everybody would agree, really stimulating, interesting discussion. The point is, well, I'll take away so many different ideas, but the one you mentioned is about also the Jewish tradition of justice, which is integral to our position, and sets a high standard for people to follow. But nobody should shirk from a challenge, really. The interesting thing is, just last week it was Shavuot, and of course I was reminded that the Torah was given on a mountain in the middle of the desert that nobody can find, Mount Sinai, not in the land of Israel. People were on the way towards it. So the Torah itself came from the world as a whole. I don't know if it's cheeky of me, but perhaps could you give us, just as a non-American, and knowing your writing about affairs in America, could you just describe the mood in America as a sort of parting shot? Because we're living through a historical moment, and what do you make? Do you see opportunities there for something good coming out of this atrocity that happened and reaction to it?
I think we're still, I feel like, so much in the eye of the storm, with so much trauma going straight from COVID into now these nationwide protests, that I think it's really hard to get perspective on this. I guess I would say, I think that what I have feel like I've seen is a kind of a death of the notion of American exceptionalism, which is essentially that there I think for a long time among many Americans, not only on the right, a sense that America had a model that was the best. You know, that we were a kind of model for the world. I honestly think that has collapsed. And maybe that's a good thing in many ways. It certainly, I think, emboldened people on the American left to say, for goodness sake, a country as powerful and rich as us can have a functioning welfare state where people don't die because they don't have healthcare, right? And I think there's been a radicalization because of the recognition of how fundamentally we failed in response to COVID, and not just because of Donald Trump, but because of decades of decay in our public sector. And that's good. There's also been a kind of renewed fervor around the age old, you know, fundamental American question of white supremacy. If Joe Biden wins, there will be a chance to begin to repair some of this stuff. It's important to remember that America is not an old democracy. America is a young democracy. America only became a democracy for African Americans, a multiracial democracy in the 1950s. In some ways, we're no older a democracy than Brazil. So the question of whether we can actually create a multiracial democracy when we were founded on the two contradictory principles of white supremacy on the one hand, or white patriarchy on the one hand, and liberal democracy on the other, and the two are in obvious active coalition as Donald Trump tries to make it harder and harder for people to vote in this coming election, we will see which principle triumphs. If democracy triumphs, if we are able to have a moderately free and fair election, and we have a president who's not a racist, we may have the beginnings to start to build something. But right now, it's a deeply, I would say, traumatized, I think, moment, at least for me.
Thank you so much. It was a tremendous answer. Thinking. Anyway, for people who still want to stay in touch, please do. And apologies to everybody who we didn't reach. There were so many questions. And really, thank you so much for the quality of the questions as well. So people, please do stay in touch with us, whether that be Merit UK in the UK or Partners for Progressive Israel. Thank you again to our partners, Karen. Sorry, Karen, did you want to say something?
You're on mute.
Or both. They should stay in touch with both organizations, and we should continue to generate conversations like this one. Thank you, Peter. You have inspired all of us to continue the work that we all need to do. And thank you, Matan, and thank you, Lawrence, for making this happen.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we'll say goodbye. And thanks again, Peter.
Bye. Thank you very much. Thank you. Really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.